Down south, they say it's the economy, stupid. Up here, we say it's the economy, eh? And this is Political Economy Radio, a progressive take on economic issues in Canada and beyond. My name is Michał Rozworski, and welcome to the show. Today's episode is an attempt to get a handle on the economic situation in broadest terms, to think about the political economy of the present. To this end, I present a feature interview with Sam Gindin. Sam is a left political economist with a long career. He was the longtime research director of the CAW, a position he held for almost a quarter century. He was also the Packer Chair in Social Justice at York University. Most recently, Sam authored The Making of Global Capitalism with Leo Panitch, a book that has gone on to win prestigious awards and spark important debates. Here, then, is my conversation with Sam Gindin. So hi, Sam. Glad to have you on the show.
Good to be here.
In planning this interview, I mentioned that I wanted it to be a conversation on the political economy of the present. And before going any further, I suppose the best thing would be to ask you about the diagnosis of where we are. I mean, of course, many cheerleaders in and around power have long declared the crisis that began in 2007 to be over. Now, however, it appears that some aspects of reality may slowly be actually catching up with their optimism. Different economic indicators, from GDP to investment, profit, and private debt, are all showing positive growth in more and more parts of the world. And while I think neither of us is a fan of empty speculation, and it is still too early to say whether capitalism is even relatively back on track globally, perhaps you could still highlight some current trends that you think point to its revival, as well as some working in the opposing direction.
Well, aside from, I guess the main thing in terms of the possibility of exiting this with, you know, moderate growth is the fact that profits are high, corporations are rolling in dough, the banks have been stabilized, interest rates are only rising slowly, so there's low interest rates. So you would think that there should be some possibility of this, of getting out of this crisis. On the other hand, this was a really traumatic crisis, and it really affected confidence. It affected both consumers and business. And it would have seemed that the way to get out of this required some dramatic stimulus to kickstart a recovery. And the stimulus was never that dramatic for a number of reasons. I think because it was always limited by the banks, who have a built-in bias for austerity. I think it was limited by the fact of a weak left to pressure them towards stimulus, which ironically might have actually helped capital as well. If you had major infrastructure, couldn't be a better time for it. And I think to some extent, they also saw this as a time to take advantage of the public sector unions and actually lead to some structural changes in the strength of labor. So we haven't had that kind of stimulus that could have really kickstarted things when there's all this cash around. You know, my own sense of where we're going is that the crisis does seem to be over. Doesn't look like there's going to be any great boom, but it does look like we'll have something more than just secular stagnation here.
Right. And I mean, I think it's interesting to hear you mention this need for stimulus. And if we could continue this vein a little longer, I mean, in The Making of Global Capitalism, your book with Leo Panitch, I think the major claim is that rather than signaling the decline of state power, globalization has actually been a process whereby states have actively created the conditions for the success of capitalism, and the United States has been at the center of this process. So you're arguing that there's actually been, you know, a lot of concerted state activity. And I'd like to see if you could say a bit more about the response of states to the crisis. And in particular, I mean, you've already mentioned it, we hear the word austerity a lot. So what exactly is the role of austerity, and what does it mean that austerity has not been applied uniformly around the world?
So on the question of austerity, I think the foundation for austerity, because you would expect that, you know, this is the ideal situation where you'd want stimulus, has to be understood in terms of finance. The first concern here, this was a financial crisis, and because it was a financial crisis, the first concern was to stabilize finance, to cater to finance. Now, that had two implications. One was that you'd have to pay for the bailout of finance, and the money had to come from someplace. So you did have, even though you were stimulating in terms of monetary policy, workers were going to pay for this. So you had austerity from that perspective. The second thing is that even as finance stabilizes, finance is always worried about inflation. In a lot of countries, it's worried about if the government is running large debts, there might even be defaults.
Right.
But in countries like Canada and the U.S., it's been more about inflation eroding things. So finance has that bias for austerity, and we haven't had the strength to challenge it. Now, in terms of how this plays out across countries, across kind of the hierarchy of countries, it's very uneven. I mean, it's even uneven in the third world. But I think one of the most significant, you may want to come back on this and talk about this more, but I think one of the most significant differences is that the U.S. actually has more space for doing things. There's a qualitative difference between the U.S. and other countries. Other countries have to worry about the outflow of capital and the nervousness about it. And the fact is that when there's any kind of real nervousness, capital comes to the United States because that's where they trust the state the most in terms of property relations and in terms of the balance of class forces. So, from that perspective, if you're looking at this through the 90s into the new millennium, the U.S. was actually attracting a lot of capital, which allowed more consumption from the working class. The difference was that workers were winning that consumption in a particular form that didn't reflect collective strength. So if you're winning your gains either through picket lines and wages or the social wage through protests and demonstration, you're building collective strength. If you're able to consume because you're going into debt, first with longer hours, or going into debt later on, then this is a very individual way of expressing your strength and in a way that's very vulnerable to any kind of interruption. So the working class was able to maintain its consumption in the U.S. uniquely relative to other countries because of the role of the American dollar and the American state and economy. But this was all very fragile and wasn't coincident with a stronger working class. So I think that's a crucial part of where we are today.
Yeah. I take your point, especially on the differentials too, and I think we see similar things in Europe too, where the center of Europe and the periphery there. And how about? I mean, you've spoken about the U.S. How about how this has functioned in Canada specifically? We saw the same sort of thing: a little bit of stimulus just to sort of. I mean, it looked like it was just to sort of keep us afloat, and then, but in reality, it seems that we've also seen a lot of austerity, and it's part of a longer trend of attacking public services. And is our economy close enough to the U.S. that we can speak of similar trends, especially with the high dollar that we had that was quite tied to the U.S. dollar, or are we a bit more sort of peripheral vis-a-vis what the trends are in the U.S.?
Well, the Canadian banking system, came through this with more stability for various reasons, including the fact that the degree of concentration and some degree of regulation. But I think what you described is accurate about Canada. There's the original stimulus because you're trying to prevent a Great Depression. That seemed necessary. The priority, too, was just, stabilize financially, hope that the U.S. recovers and tag along the American recovery. I don't think there was much autonomy. But like the U.S., there was some concern about depression. Part of this was actually coordinated. A lot of the international stimulus was the U.S. actually trying to coordinate countries to do some coordinated stimulus, and kind of informally it actually happened. There was some stimulus rather than, what you saw during the Great Depression. There was very little protectionism that actually emerged in this crisis, even though it was so deep. The degree of integration and the U.S. role really meant that the response to this crisis had to do with some degree of stimulus everywhere, but also, and this is, I think, what you're getting at, using the crisis to really enforce discipline, both you know, both because you needed some of this discipline to pay off finance and to keep finance secure, but also it was an opportunity to enforce that discipline. I see that discipline really powerfully in the southern regions of Europe, and in terms of looking at Canada, you know, it's involved that attack on the public sector to make sure that the public sector doesn't have the autonomy to set standards for the private sector. Now that you've kicked around the private sector, which happened before this crisis, you have to make sure that the public sector isn't insulated from market forces. So it's a more political thing. So it sets standards for the private sector. So you see this attack on the public sector, but you also see, you know, as countries have their deficits, partly because of financing the bailouts, but mostly because of the deep downturn, you get these deficits, and then the deficits are used to justify privatizations. So what you get coming out of this isn't what a lot of people thought would happen, which was this is the death of neoliberalism. You actually see an intensification of neoliberalism. And the death of neoliberalism had to do with people mistakenly thinking that, well, the government's going to get involved, so that's not neoliberalism. But if you think of neoliberalism in terms of class terms, in class terms, as the making and deepening of capitalism and removing barriers to that making, weakening the working class so it can't do that, integrating the working class individually so it doesn't have resistance, what you really see is a strengthening of neoliberalism.
Yeah, that seems, I mean, that seems exactly right. And I think, I mean, I think you've talked about the state, and we've talked about finance a bit, and maybe you could just say a few more words about how sort of these fiscal austerity policies and the sort of monetary expansion that you've mentioned about already coming from central banks, how these may be working to sort of reinforce the centrality of finance, so sort of bringing this analysis of the state and of finance together, and how these might be working to actually enable finance to penetrate new areas of life, and then also propping up the accumulation that's going on where this has already happened.
Mm-hmm. Two ways of thinking about this. I mean, the first thing is that we have to take finance more seriously. I mean, there's always been a tendency on the left to see finance as primarily linked to providing credit for accumulation. And then as finance went beyond that, to see it in speculative terms. Or that's just where you put your money because it's not profitable someplace else. Or just in a really functional way that finance is just there to give people money so that the economy can keep going. We have to really see finance as, you know, an element of capitalism that has been developing alongside the development of capitalism, and its particular expansion is linked to overall changes in capitalism. So finance is really, you know, the fact that corporations have had so much profit and haven't depended on credit as much as they did in the past has been a challenge to finance to find new areas of business. And the way they found them is in providing new kinds of services, derivatives and, you know, addressing, taking a risk out of exchange rates has been really fundamental, because that's been fundamental to being able to globalize as much as corporations have been able to globalize. Finance has been critical to the restructuring of the economy and financing mergers, for venture capital, especially in the United States, venture capital and high tech. It's been critical to disciplining. You know, the fact that capital is so mobile, finance capital is so mobile, means that it's constantly putting pressure on workplaces to extract more surplus. It's reallocating the surplus. It's been critical to the imperial role of the United States because of being able to attract capital and then, you know, its role in containing crisis and quantitative easing. So there's all those dimensions of finance, which has, you know, become such a crucial part of the overall economy. Then there's the fact that in terms of how the economy is managed, we've moved from fiscal policy, not exclusively moved, but it's much more greater weight to monetary policy. And again, that's, you know, that's because the fiscal part of this is so political. You have to deal with revenues and taxes, whereas if you're regulating the economy through finance, it's such a, you know, particularly capitalist way of doing things. It's in the market, nobody to blame. It seems automatic. It's technical. So you've seen finance in that way. And then to your question of how this relates to the deepening of capitalism, how finance relates to it, it's finance has played this crucial role materially and culturally in terms of making all our calculations into financial calculations. You know, so at the level of individuals, beginning to see your home as an asset, watching stock markets all the time because that matters to your pension, the capacity of finance to deal with privatizing major operations means that, things that used to be seen as the commons in some way, some things that were never private, become commodified again. Healthcare starts becoming more and more commodified. Education becomes commodified. So everything begins to follow the logic of capital and finances, and so central to that. Oh, I should say the other point. I'm sorry. The integration of the working class, and I mentioned some of it in terms of the calculations, but the integration of the working class, you know, in terms of they actually have assets now. I mean, part of the point is the working class did make gains through the post-war period, and they really have gains and they have assets, and some of these assets, they are sharing in the increase in wealth. Housing assets or pension funds, and so again, they're kind of brought into this overall financial nexus, where they see more and more of their well-being dependent on, especially since wages have been constrained.
I think it's interesting that you mentioned that, and we're slowly running out of time, so I do want to ask one more question, and maybe link that into the comments you've just made. And basically, where that leaves us, where the situation leaves us in terms of possible resistance, because as you've said, we've seen people being more integrated into these circuits and generally benefiting from them.
Yeah.
So, I mean, what space? And on the other hand, we've seen sort of, you know, an institutional decay in many respects on the part of formal organizations that were once sort of, you know, bulwarks against capitalism to some extent. So yeah, I mean, the most general question is where does that leave us? And you know, as the crisis recedes from attention, and we're back to this sort of to this rhetoric of the gains that we're making and you know shared gains. What are the openings and the spaces that are left and that are most promising for a durable and sort of reinvigorated working class self-organization and means of resistance?
Yeah, I think you posed the question really well. I think a number of things. I mean, I guess the place I'd start with is that if the left is actually going to be able to change things, it'll have to convince workers that capitalism is a lousy system even when it's working well. But capitalism itself is a barrier to human development, never mind whether your wages are rising by 1% or 2%, that your life is just narrower and shittier and more insecure, and democracy means less, and your kids are going to expect less. That capitalism, you know, the environment, that capitalism is the problem. And I think that's one thing. We shouldn't just sit around and hope that, well, a deeper recession will make people radical. Usually a deeper recession just makes people want to fix the system and get back to the way it was, and the way it was suddenly looks pretty good. So that's one thing in terms of what we have to do. The other thing is that, in my experience, there is more of a sense of capitalism not, you know, meeting our needs than there has ever been. You know, anybody talking to workers, talking to young people, people know this. The problem is, you know, what you pose, which is, well, what can you do about it? Capitalism isn't legitimating itself anymore on all it can offer. It's legitimating itself by, sorry, you don't have a choice, so that's why this is what you're stuck with. And this gets to your point about what's been happening with working class organizations, which should be an opening for the left. I mean, it is clear that unions in their present form cannot deal with these problems. They're sectional organizations, not class organizations. And unless they have a class sensibility, I don't think they can even strategize about how to do more. So there's a vacuum in unions. The NDP is obviously irrelevant to this kind of change. It isn't interested in building working class capacities or challenging capitalism in any fundamental way. It just administers the system, and there's less and less room to operate on that. The right has recognized, I mean, the right generally, capital, has recognized that options have been polarized and they had to become more radical. That's what neoliberalism is about. So there's a message here too. We have to become just as radical. We have to be just as conscious of the polarization of options. So I think the opportunity is to say, look, we used to be written off on the left as being impractical. And now I think there's an opportunity to say that just muddling along is what's impractical. The only thing that's actually practical now is the radical. And that's an organizational question. And we have to actually create. This is, I think we have to come back to the left itself, not just unions and the NDP. We have to come back to the socialist left and with some humility and ask about our failure to create the kinds of structures and organizations with all the vacuum and all the opportunity that exists that can convince people that there are structures through which you can work and they will matter. That the argument that you have to bring class into unions matters. The fact that workers' class doesn't stop at the factory gate or the workplace gate, and we have to build the working class in the community matters. That we can't just add unions and movements because you're just adding two things that each of which isn't that effective. They both have to be transformed. I mean, all these, I think these are the questions, that the opportunity is there, that we have to get our shit together as a left and start building the kind of structures that give people confidence that they can fight through. And there's historical precedence for this, but, when you're sober about it, it's very difficult because the extent of the defeat, the extent to which expectations have been lowered, and the extent to which socialism as an idea has been defeated. So it makes it very hard, but there's nothing else to do except to revive that idea, and through reviving that idea, really start creating those kinds of structures. I think the question of organizational structures is fundamental.
All right. A big task ahead of us. I think we'll have to stop it there. I wish we could keep the conversation going. Sam, it was a great pleasure to speak with you today.
Okay. And nice to talk to you, by the way.
That was Sam Gindin, radical political economist and author with Leo Panitch of The Making of Global Capitalism. Thanks for listening. I'll be back in 2 weeks.